Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to the restart of the Bog right here on Dave Martell channel. As you all know, unfortunately, we had to migrate over from Hrafnfolk channel. I took a little bit of a break, but because of everybody's requests, the Bog is back here on our new slot. So, everybody, welcome back to the Bog. I am Big Dave Martell here on Dave Martell's channel. This channel could go through a little bit of a transformation up here very soon. So make sure you like, subscribe, share. If you like this, program and all the other programs that I have coming, I do car videos. We got more content coming your guys' way. You're going to absolutely love it. Like, subscribe, share right here. Before we get started with everything, you know, my former co-host, Mr. Angriff, unfortunately had to leave us. He's got a lot of life stuff that he's focusing on. He's working on his career and all that stuff, so unfortunately had to leave. But before we get into the Bog, I absolutely want to give a shout-out to my homeboy, my brother, Mr. Angriff, and I want to give him a warm thank you from the bottom of my heart for all the awesome work and awesome content that he brought to the Bog, not just as a co-host, but as a friend. So, Mr. Angriff, I'm going to raise a glass to you, my friend. Thank you so much for all the work you put in. Press 9 in the chat to hail Angriff. Many blessings to you. And the Bog is always open for whenever you want to come pop back in and grace us with your presence. And also, my home is always open. So if you ever want to come visit old Dave and have a meal with the Penfolk kindred, you're more than welcome, always. So hail Angriff. All right, so let's get started here tonight with a plug for Traditional Apothecary. Go to traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Make sure you get some of this stuff, man. I use it. My wife uses it. My mom uses it. Dr. G uses it. Stop giving your money to these multinational globalist corporations that hate your guts. They put out all kinds of propaganda. You guys see it. Stop giving them your money. Give your money to somebody that loves you, that cares about you. Real homegrown, real stuff, organic stuff that grows from the earth. You know, it's from the United States. It's from Europe. All kinds of great stuff. It's good for your hair, good for your skin, good for your body. Our ancestors gifted us with so many beautiful, wonderful features. And, stop giving your money to these vampires, man. They absolutely despise you. Support folk economy. Go over to traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Promo code Dave to get 10% off. All right, so let's get started here. We got all that stuff out of the way. I'd like to introduce my new co-host, Mr. Tristan from Ari Akasha, and a colleague over at Neurona Society, the very smart, very talented, very interesting Mr. Tristan. How are we doing tonight, sir? Hell yeah. I can't wait, man. So, Mr. Tristan, who we got with us? We got someone pretty interesting here, right?
Yes, today we have my good friend and colleague from Ari Akasha, Mr. Kerwin Rawlinson.
I believe there's also customarily an Aries in the middle of that, but sure, that's a nice intro.
Yeah. Mr. Kerwin has actually been on my program a few times already, as well as Mr. Tristan, and you guys are familiar with the Ari Akasha and all the awesome work that they do with the Proto-Indo-European kind of research that they get into and the cognates between the Sanatana Dharma tradition as well as the Germanic tradition. And Mr. Tristan is like me. He's of the Asatru Setian faith, and then Mr. Kerwin is of the Sanatana Dharma faith. Before we get started into everything we're going to talk about, Mr. Kerwin, I know there are a few, I'm not really that smart with Sanatana Dharma, but I do know that there are a few different, sects of Sanatana Dharma, and there's a few different, I guess you could say paths, right? A few different traditions within, under the umbrella of Sanatana Dharma. You have, Vaishnava, which are kind of like the guys that are, I might have pronounced that wrong, but there's guys that are, they're sort of like monists, like we have Sri Dharma Acharya, who's I'm a big, big fan of, but he's kind of like a monist. And then also there's like a polytheist kind of branch. Before I butcher any of the theology any further, can you give us a quick introduction to what is your path within Sanatana Dharma and maybe a quick explanation for some of the other paths that are under the umbrella? Because this is a question that comes up a lot.
Well, that's all good. One thing I've just remembered before I get back into my heavy-duty theological explication is one small request. while I'm on this particular show, this particular episode, The Bog, I should like to rechristen is the wrong word to use, re-pagan, the title of the show to The Bog. Now, why I'm doing this is because the bog in a Nordic sort of context is a place where you'd be sending outcasts and people who are ignominious, whereas the bog in a Slavic context, deriving from a bugger in the sort of ancient, Sanskrit Indo-Iranian sense, means godly, divine, lordly. So while I'm in the bog, it is the bog, not the bog. Now that we've that out of the way.
No, I'm going to have to get you there, Kerwin. You see, what is the bog if not a place of supreme Germanic judgment and civil justice? And that is what we do here on the bog. We judge and make just.
That's personally, right. I prefer to be sitting where the judge be holding the hammer as opposed to be sitting in the dock as an accused. But that is just a personal point on that particular note. You wind up hanging from the same tree anyway. Okay. But in terms of the getting back to the Hindu theology sort of side of things, now the reason why we have these different approaches is because over the course of the last sort of 4,000 years, there were quite some developments within the, I suppose you call it the Hindu religion, the Vedic religion. And then, of course, the post-Vedic forms of Hinduism, which I know Tristan wants me to talk about a bit later on. Now, in terms of our overall cosmological setup, nobody seriously denies that we have gods, plural. Sometimes we talk about these gods using different labels. So if you're of a Hare Krishna disposition, then you tend to go around annoying the hell out of everybody by insistently terming everybody else's gods as demigods, which is unhelpful because the term which they're generally translating, deva, Deva, which is cognate with Deus in Latin. It means effectively shining one, if you go back to the original Proto-Indo-European, which it's sort of based off. They tend to translate that as demigod rather than god because they have a bit of a one-upsmanship thing going on. But in terms of our cosmological setup, we believe in a, exterior to the universe, exterior to reality, absolute. Now, what that absolute is it varies depending on which sect you're talking about. I would personally be saying Adi Parashakti, which is basically the Adi meaning sort of first, Para meaning once again sort of from the preceding. It's the same root as perimeter. Shakti, of course, meaning power. It's a sort of I don't want to sort of connote this sort of thing, but it's a sort of female creative principle, you might sort of say. But Brahman, as in the absolute, that is also an acceptable way to phrase it. And most especially, as correlate with the Germanic, the Nordic path, would be Rita. My Sanskrit's appalling as well, so don't worry too much about it. But Rita, as in cosmic order. Now, I can sense some percolations in the prefrontal cortexes of my illustrious hosts, because Rita is directly correlate conceptually with the ancient Greek concept of the Kaosune, I believe is the technical way of phrasing it, or Orlog. Or meaning sort of outside, beyond. Log meaning basically sort of law. So in terms of this absolute, which precedes, presages quite literally the universe, there is a certain level of correlate for it within Germanic thought, within Greek thought, although not generally speaking as defined, as personified is exactly the wrong word to use, but also exactly the right one, as it turns up in Hindu thinking, even at the really early sort of Vedic sort of layers of the Rig Vedic hymns, which we often draw quite strongly upon. So in terms of why we have those different paths, which may emphasize a lot more strongly that monist conception, which you're sort of talking about, it's because those guys tend to try and cut out the middleman, you might sort of say, and go directly to, more directly, we should say, towards that absolute, as opposed to all the stuff in the middle. Now, that is not what I tend to advocate or what I tend to do. The way in which I personally would approach things is not going, okay, so Brahman, closely correlate with Krishna. Therefore, you know, sort of Krishna's direct sort of pathway to Brahman. All good. We'll just go down that particular path and never mind all the other deities. That is not what we do. That's what a lot of the Vaishnavas tend to do. The way we tend to approach it is by noting that even if all people, that's, you know, people on our sort of layer of things, at the core spark of their being, that particular core spark is part of some sort of glorious, grand, underpinning reality, raging inferno. That does not mean that you suddenly go up to somebody in the street and go, we're identical, I'm you, you're me, there's no difference between us. That's not a sensible way to actually interface with the world, and you're probably going to wind up in some very curious situations, depending on what drugs you're on at the time, if you actually try and put that into practice. So in a similar sort of manner, when it comes to the gods, plural, even if, and I stress I said if there, you're running on the idea that all the gods are effectively various facings, if you like, of, you know, sort of one monist sort of underpinning point. It does not make sense to abjure the reality of engaging with the gods, plural, by actually trying to agglomerate them all into a single formless pre-entity, because that just is not how we do things, and it is not the most efficient path to actually navigate our reality. Now, in terms of my own personal devotional path, I suppose you might sort of say, the ends of the pantheon which resonate most strongly with myself, as you, some of you will be able to tell by some of my rambling pre-intro tangents, are the Shakti, but also Shaivite devotional paths. Now, to explicate this more in Nordic terms for your listeners who may not be more familiar with our end of things, Shiva would be broadly speaking, in fact, not even broadly speaking, very specifically speaking, cognate, correlate with Odin. Like, I've written an entire massive, like 16,000 word article called Ghost Division, which explores these parallels in quite some more significant and strong depth. In terms of the other Indo-European pantheonic setups, the two deific sort of facings that Shiva, Rudra, as we'd also sort of know him, the Aurora, the Howler, the roaring of the storm wind, the howling of the storm wind, we'd also say. The other deific sort of complex expressions which this deity would be strongly correlate with would be Deus Pater. That's not me speaking like Catholic Latin, although it is amusing that the Catholics have borrowed an ancient Indo-European theological term, but God the Father, or Deus Pater, as we know in Sanskrit, so you can see the etymological correlate right there, which also turns up in later classical mythology as Zeus Pater, Zeus Pater, so Zeus the Father, Jupiter. You can see exactly the same sort of thing going on there. But also in terms of the Interpretatio Romanum sort of end of things, Interpreto Romanum, Hermes, Mercury, that end of things, and how those fit together, Dionysus as well. Tristan is thinking quite strongly at me in that particular regard. So that should help situate that particular deity in the minds of the non-Hindu listenership. Now, the other portion of that pair which I mentioned is his wife. Known by many names, as of course many deities are. In fact, there's a strong principle of Odinic theology around having many names when you are amidst the people, as of course previously discussed. Yeah. Parvati would be one of the more prominent sort of ways to refer to this particular goddess. Parvati means mountain. It is a etymological particle which turns up also, funnily enough, directly in Frigg in Freya. In terms of the Nordic sort of setup, there's a PF sound shift which goes on with a lot of these sort of languages, which sort of helps to explicate it. But it's also known as Durga, especially in the sort of the warrior goddess sort of aspect or form. And of course, when she gets really mad, and because Tristan is now in my head for some reason, if to phrase it in Dragon Ball Z terms, in the instances whereby the Super Saiyan state of Devi, goddess, is sort of achieved, you may know her as Kali, which I'm, of course, egregiously mispronouncing once again. Now, speaking of Super Saiyans and things of that particular nature, these are also very Indo-European. Mm-hmm. And not simply because you wind up in a situation whereby, to quote Tristan's father upon the matter, His hair turns blonde, his eyes turn blue, and he's now more powerful. But I digress. If you look at the deity Hanuman, Hanuman is the monkey deity. He's a Vanara. Now, Hanuman is also, and this is how this fits into the divine family, which is the core of how we run our particular devotional approach. Hanuman is one of the sons of Shiva. He's also the guy who goes around with a big club, a big mace, has phenomenal sort of strength. Badrang Bali, of course, means both the strength and, of course, the lightning force, which, of course, is the Vajra, the club which he's sort of wielding, and is, funnily enough, reasonably directly cognate with the Nordic Thor. In fact, in the course of our research, by which I mean Tristan making two and two put together makes 108 connection one day, we actually found in Old Norse an attestation for Thor being referred to as an ape. It was a revelation that there was actually a term for ape in Old Norse, yeah. But it was right there, and it was, as you can see, directly correlate, even in terms of something which you would assume was not correlate at all, i.e. having a monkey, something which is not really very common in the sort of the Nordic sort of cold lands,
sure.
Being correlate in terms of both iconographic representation.
It really is a particularly famous issue with Norse linguistics here, because none of the academics can really explain why Old Norse has a word for ape, especially at the time period they're talking about. There are some theories that it may have been brought into the language, especially at the Rus point by trade and whatnot, but mm-hmm. It doesn't appear to be so. And there are some issues with that it may derive from like a water spirit of some sort of that, but they're really, really shaky and they don't seem to hold up. And it is my personal opinion that it is, in fact, a linguistically original word for ape.
That's really incredible stuff right there. Yeah, you guys do a lot of this work with figuring out the cognates and figuring out like the origins of some of these words. And man, I read like almost all of the stuff that you guys put out on Arya Kasha and the stuff that you guys personally post on Facebook. And it just really blows my mind. I think I left a comment on one of your guys' posts pretty recently. It was about, I pretty much said something along the lines of, years ago, when I first started practicing Asatru, I still had this, the American idea that Hinduism or Sanatana Dharma, whatever you want to call it, was this really foreign kind of alien thing that, people practice that owned, gas stations. Yeah, you know, that's what I just thought of gas station people. You know, what the religion that they practiced that had, whatever. But now when I look at it, because of the work that you guys do and because of, like, a lot of the research I've done, it no longer feels unfamiliar. It no longer feels like an alien thing. And in fact, I see so much familiarity that I at this point, I think we could comfortably say that Asatru and Setianism are indeed either cousins to Sanatana Dharma, or even might even fall under the umbrella of Sanatana Dharma. What do you think about that, Tristan? I know you also have. We're running out of time here, and I know you also have some questions. So if you don't mind answering that, and then we can kind of segue into all the stuff that you wanted to hit too.
Right, absolutely, and that's a fascinating question too. I generally take the position that my faith should be considered a subgroup of the Indo-European faith as a whole. That it's all the same gods, it's all the same beings. They're not different religions, but they're kind of like sects, like how Hinduism has Vaishnavism, and they have Shaivism and Shaktism and Smarta. And these are all different sects. They believe slightly different things about, metaphysics, the gods, however they view it. But they all do come together. And in a sense, you could say that Sethianism is a type of Sadatama Dharma, but that has some issues to it. It has some appropriative issues that the religion in general is more comprised in India. I think it's most reasonable to kind of separate them at that point, but it's also reasonable to make sure that there is a definite connection between the two. Very close kinship, almost like sects of one another.
What I would say, because this gets right to the foundations of NAS, the Nordic Aryan Sangha, our monastic order, is Sanatana Dharma, to translate it directly. Dharma, I often translate it as duty. It basically means something which is sort of, which you hang your hat off, basically. It's sort of like the nail on a hitching post. Sanatana means eternal. And in terms of how we tend to run it, the idea is that it's the same truth being revealed in different ways to the sages of various different Indo-European peoples. Now, to therefore coin a specific variant of it for the concept we're discussing right now, the Indo-European umbrella, Samrajya Dharma. I've, again, egregiously mispronounced that, but I digress. Now, Samrajya is a word I've been doing a bit of work with recently because it directly translated would mean imperial. However, slightly less directly translated, it in fact means the same rule. Rajya, you know, sort of rulership, Raj, you can see the obvious correlate there. And, of course, fair and just rule extended out in an imperial sort of manner. That, to my mind, is kind of what we're discussing here when it comes to that same core truth emanating out via the various Indo-European peoples. Now, to speak directly about the core underpinning of Nast theology, the reason why we actually, I'll jump it back a bit to sort of address how we actually got to Nast in the first place, because this is directly relevant to what you said about your own personal journey, Dave, from the gas station attendant approach through to the, okay, well, maybe I can see some of my people working in gas stations. I don't know. The point is, in terms of my own personal background, I didn't decide to get into all of this. It sort of decided I was going to get into it, and it dragged me kicking and screaming whether I liked it or not. Eventually, I decided, okay, well, we may as well get really good at it because we're going to be doing it anyway. I happen to have Indo-Nepali adoptive family. It's a long story as to how that happened. There was a debt of honor involved, which was an appropriately Nordic way to do things, I know. Point is, I found myself at a temple one day in early 2016, and I was in front of the Durga, that's the goddess, Murti, which is sort of like a living statue, another concept which also turns up in the traditional Nordic approach to things. I digress. The point is, I was sitting in front of that Murti, and I basically got told to do something, which was re-illuminate the shared bonds of co-immunity, of shared heritage, and the fact that it's all closely connected and towards the same sort of purpose between the various Indo-European peoples. And the interesting thing is, the way in which I was told, well, part of the purpose to which this was put was to be remaking the world in her image, this being the mother goddess of the Indo-European people. You can quite easily see how that starts to fit together. Part of what I was supposed to do was set up a research institute, which I, of course, did, to gather around this particular mission, the people would be able to help me to make that actually possible. Now, a few months later, Tristan and a number of other people we know turned up out of the woodwork in one of those. Buddha has a quote about how, you know, two close friends, when they meet, it's an encounter which is 500 years in the making. It's kind of one of those sorts of things. Yeah. But in terms of where that sort of led to, we basically was doing our research. And we kept happening across stuff from the Nordic myth or religious corpus and the Hindu end of things, whereby it wasn't as loose as occasionally it kind of is in some of these spheres, as simple linguistic cognates as, okay, so you can sort of see how these things fit together. It was stuff whereby it was directly, this is the same thing. Like, admittedly, in some occasions, it's the same thing filtered through several generations worth of some reinterpretation and some local sort of metaphysical alterations. But broadly speaking, they seem to be so close as to really, as Tristan has put it, be two sects of the same religion. Now, in terms of the comparison with some Hindu sects, I'd actually say that there is far more co-terminity between a Shaivite doctrine, especially the way I tend to run things, and a Nordic myth or religious approach, than there would be between myself and, say, Hare Krishna, some of the more, I'm going to say gaudy, and that's a multilinguistic pun, Vaishnava approaches which we tend to encounter from time to time. They're just simply that close. So in terms of our core fundamental mission, what we tend to believe is that we are re-illuminating these particular paths without abrogating the necessary distinctiveness between them, on the basis that we tend to believe rather strongly that these particular differences were often handed down deliberately to the particular peoples who were in receipt of them. And a great example of that, which we'll probably get onto later on in the show, is the difference between the Vedic caste system and the Germanic caste system in terms of the social purpose. But I think you're starting to get a sense of where it is we're coming at when we talk about these sorts of things. We don't view it, as you said, as being different religions. We view it as one religion being expressed differently, and occasionally, in some cases, having been corrupted or misunderstood, especially in the Greek case, as the years have ground on.
All right. Now, Kermit, I want to stop you here, because when you're talking about how we know certain things are similar, very close together, or cognate, I see some of the people already bucking up in the chat at the concept here. Can you explain a bit more about how we actually know that these things derive from the same source, the same origin, that it's not just seeing shadows on the wall, they're not just superficially similar?
Well, funny thing about shadows on the wall is that I hate Platonism, but if you find yourself with one particular light source and one particular thing which is in between the light and the wall, and you got two walls which it happens to be refracting on, it can be quite reasonable to go, okay, so we can see how these things sort of relate in terms of the past or shadow. But in terms of the actual serious academic analysis, me and Tristan are constantly amused and bemused at the number of people who seem to think we made up the field of Indo-European studies out of whole cloth. If only that we could take that kind of credit. No, it's a serious academic discipline. It's been going on for about 200 years now. Now, the fields which we draw upon to make these sorts of connections, there are many of them pretty hard science. We'll start out with the genetics, because that's quite relevant, especially with some of the recent studies on the genomic foundation of South Asia, which have recently come out. And also because I know you Nordic guys. We Nordic guys. I'm also quite strongly Swedish, as of course we all know now. Are quite strong upon the idea of, what's it called, the Yarnax scale, in terms of only letting in people who are, Northern European.
Folkish.
Right, the Yarnsaxis, so it's the difference between universalism and folkish and the in-betweens.
Yeah, although I would note with some amusement, we do tend to grandfather in, great-grandfather, you might sort of say, Buthara, etc., some of our Indian associates on the basis that if you genetically test them, they're going to come back somewhere between 23 and 50% Nordic, just on the basis of gene clustering. But you know, I'll dial it back a bit. In terms of the genetic analysis of this sort of stuff, we can trace the ancestry of people in Northern Europe, people in Southern Europe. That's a bit controversial, either to a side. People in Iran, people in the Caucasus, people in Russia, people in India and Nepal, areas like that. And once upon a time, people in Western China, although there's been some repression of that, we might sort of say, back to a single set of sources in what's known as the Urhimat, the original homeland of the Indo-Europeans, likely on the Pontic steppe about 7,000 years ago or thereabouts. From there, these guys, our ancestors, all of our ancestors, diffused out in multiple directions. Some went west, some went east, some went west, then east, some went east, then west. It got quite complex, especially in terms of a reinflux from the Indo-Iranian end of things into both Slavic and sort of Baltic linguistics and genetics.
Well, I believe the oldest, I believe they found some sort of, I don't know if it was a building or a wall or the remnants of a building or something that they dug up, and there's also some trinkets and some metallurgy and stuff like that. And they also found some bodies, and these are like the oldest examples of Indo-Europeans that they've dug up, and those were actually found in Ukraine.
Yep, that's where the Pontic steppe is. Yeah. You're probably talking about Yamnaya pit grave culture stuff, but yep. Exactly. But in terms of the archaeological side of things, because the archaeogenetics is one side of things, and it's a pretty hard proof around the fact that there's a hell of a lot of shared heredity going on. Now, the joke me and Tristan often make about this is a core part of how archaeogenetics works is haplogroup analysis. Now, haplogroups come in a number of different varieties, but the one we tend to focus upon is the paternal haplogroup. Paternal haplogroup traces, I should say, your particular line of patrilineal descent back to a shared common ancestor. One of the most common in the Indo-European field is R1A. It comes in a number of different subclades, so to speak. But that basically is one of the core Indo-European ones from these guys in the Ukraine you're talking about. Now, the funny thing is, not all white people, and I hate the term white people because it erases a lot of meaningful distinction. I'll put it that way. Albinos and Bug and a whole bunch of other people. Anyway, I digress. The point is, if you look at a Finnish person's haplogroup, a lot of them, about 50% or thereabouts, and I think it's Estonians as well, some of them Baltic peoples, they don't have Indo-European haplogroups. What they have with their, I think their N-type haplogroups, is a quasi-Mongolian one that happened to sort of like turn up amidst the Indo-Europeans, at some point within the last sort of few thousand years. So the joke we make about this, which isn't really that much of a joke, is that if you're going to be autistically racist about it, by which I mean properly racist, then a Finnish person is not white, but an Iranian person is. So this is why, taking a strictly genetic approach to these sorts of things can be quite illuminating and also can seriously throw out a lot of the preconceptions people have, especially with another game interest in play with this sort of thing called Indian or Italian, whereby if somebody insists that they can phenotypically tell apart, white from non-white, we present a bunch of photos of Italian people, often from the south of Italy, and a bunch of photos of, Indian people, Bollywood actors, that sort of stuff, and go, okay, so which ones of these are white? Which ones of these are European? It's a surprisingly difficult game to play, especially because I tend to cheat wildly by introducing into these particular photo lineups photographs of Nuristani, Kalash people who are from Afghanistan, Pakistan, that sort of area. And these guys have blue eyes, blonde hair. They look kind of like my brother-in-law, actually.
Oh, it's quite amazing, actually. The one picture we have of the Afghani tribesmen is a dead ringer for my own father.
It sounds like this
As
game
we
is going to trigger me.
Right. We generally use a more southern Italian than you, Dave. But, we could work you up in the next game.
And also, I'm only half Italian. Just to put that out there, I'm only half. Half Calabrese, to be more specific, and my other half is I have Swiss and Dutch, so half Germanic, well, half Mediterranean.
What I'd actually point out is that this is a tangent, but it's a cool tangent. Is when it comes to Italian population genetics, there's no real hard and fast this is Italian versus this isn't. A lot of the northern Italian bits and pieces are, in fact, Nordic anyway.
Yeah.
Now, a classic example of this is James Gandolfini, great actor. You look at his surname, Gandolfini, Gandalf. You see, it's a Nordic particle. There's a hell of a lot of them going on.
See, that
here.
Is one of the most interesting things about ancient history when you get right down to population movement and migrations. See, the ancient Romans used to refer to Sweden, what we now call Sweden area, as the womb of the world. And in fact, we now know that this is very true for Europe in general. The Germanic peoples were populated intermittently through the ages through several different migrations from Sweden. The people there are very prosperous because of the areas around Uppsala, which, as we might know, is also sacred to Freyr. It makes sense that it would be very prosperous.
Yeah.
That they have a population explosion, and then they migrate down south, conquer everyone, and take the land and interbreed. And over this time, the Germanic people in actual Germania, as the Romans knew it, were almost indistinguishable from Scandinavians.
And I see.
As this happened, they tended to move down to also get in places like Gaul and even Poland yeah. and northern Italy as well. So many of these people are in fact Germanic, even though we think of them as being Central European or maybe Italian, Mediterranean, that sort of thing.
I think it's also important to note that modern Italians now are completely different genetically than ancient Romans. The peninsula of Italy has been conquered. Because when I got my genetic test like years ago or whatever, and I saw, I was like, it was like not nearly as much Italian as I thought there was going to be, and then there's bits and pieces of weird, Germanic stuff in there. I was like, this doesn't make sense. My parents lied to me, or like whatever. And then I later researched that modern Italians are heavily Germanicized because of the invasions from the Germanic tribes. The Goths, the Lombards, they conquered all the way down to, you know, Calabria, where my mom's family's from. They actually, I read that they had like a little settlement there, and so all the way down southern Italy, the Lombards did. You know, and they set up to, I guess there was like a... There's like a port there that still belonged to the Byzantine Empire at the time, and they were fixing on raiding it and taking it over. I'm not sure if they ever did or whatever, but they had a settlement right outside of that they lived there, and they obviously spread their genes there. And so, therefore, modern Italians are heavily Germanicized. If an ancient Roman saw a guy from Florence today, he'd be like, "Get out of here, you Germanic."
Barbarian.
Yeah, get out of here, barbarian.
Well, I don't know about that. They might have taken you on as hired labor for the army. But in terms of, when Theodoric got to the gates of Rome, as the apocryphal tale goes, he looked upon what he found in disgust and boldly declared, "We're more Roman than you Romans are these days." And he was not far wrong in terms of the culture and side of things. But the point I was going to pick up is on that ruminations things, and then we will get back to the archaeology and the diffusion and the linguistic analysis, of course, is the various ethnonyms which we tend to find for an array of Germanic peoples turning up around the place. Goth, Geat, Gaute, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. One of the likely predicates for it is, in fact, it's one of the terms that actually underpins God as well. It's a term which means to pour forth. As it applies God, it means in the sense of, you know, pouring a libation. But in terms of the ethnonyms, the idea is that they're pouring forth from the north, that's a nice rhyme, and casually invading and sacking everything as they go down. Now, this is a fundamentally Indo-European thing to do, and brings me directly back to archaeology. I love when a tangent sort of rejoins the mainstream like that. It's great. Because we can actually trace, not just via the genetic side of stuff, and I'd like to briefly make a point about this because it does come up. The genetic analysis we're running on to make these assertions around the idea that a North Indian Brahmin has a huge degree of genetic co-determinity with somebody from Poland or somebody from Sweden, these aren't the 23andMe, like that kind of level of analysis. Yeah, sure, that does show it as well, partially because they're not quite sure how to handle Proto-Indo-European genetics at 23andMe for obvious reasons. We're actually referencing academic-grade, proper cutting-edge research in this particular field. In fact, the lead study on this, the Narasimhan et al. Study, which just came out a few months ago in its final form, this is absolutely comprehensive, has been rigorously critiqued and argued against by just about everybody with a dog in the fight who doesn't want to believe it, and it's still standing. So that's how rigorous it is, but I digress. Getting back to the archaeology side of stuff. Now, one of the fundamental things which Indo-Europeans tend to do is we migrate and we set things on fire. Now, that might sound like I'm sort of exaggerating, but I'm really not, because when you get to the Anatolian Indo-European peoples, that's the Hittites and people like that. Also, the Luwians, the Lycians, the Trojans, funnily enough, also fit into that particular rubric.
What about the Scythians?
We'll get on to that in a moment. That's a fascinating – those are the guys often keeping the traditions alive, so thanks for bringing them up. But in terms of the Hittite example, the reason why we can tell with reasonable precision when they turned up in Anatolia is because when they get to a place, there's a depositional layer of carbon from the city being on fire, followed by the city being rebuilt in a rather different image and under new management, which they can sort of take over. So this is a consistent pattern wherever you go, is then the Europeans show up. We can tell this, generally speaking, because things were on fire and some wealth got redistributed, you might sort of say, which is the Baga tradition I referenced at the early sort of part of it. Now, the Scythians, great that you brought that up. These guys inhabited the area that is pretty broad. Like it's an incredibly broad area. It stretches from the Pontic steppe, which we were just sort of talking about, just north of Greece, all the way through to Afghanistan and even points, further east of that, the Tarim Basin of Central Asia.
And it's it almost reaches China, just to give people an idea of how far the Scythians had an area of.
It does reach China. Like, we actually have stuff in Chinese Imperial Chronicles talking about these gosh darn different hair color, different nose-shaped barbarians who are sacking the place. Sacking. I might actually check to see if that's etymologically related.
That's also how you know that you're dealing with the Indo-Europeans, because the people looking at their keep writing down, these people came out of nowhere and they keep destroying us.
Yeah, that's what we do. Now, I mean, in terms of... actually, we'll introduce some theology here, because this is a large part of... what my Ghost Division article was on, in principle, was Urn and Shiva. Now, both deities have retinues, which are kind of like what they are, so to speak. Guys who turn up on horseback a lot of the time. Odin has the Wild Hunt, amongst others. Rudra, Shiva has the Butogana, amongst many sort of others. And, of course, the Rudras, who ride around on what I am going to charitably describe as celestial motorbikes. I mean, it's a slightly odd way to characterize it, but they're described as kind of like chariots without horses, which make a really loud roaring sound as they ride across the sky. So motorbikes in the sky, I like it, so I'm going to stick with it. But in terms of – Tristan's going to tell me off of techno-theology, I can tell. But in terms of what this represents, these particular deities, if you look at the Scythians' Indo-European religion, these guys kept the traditions of the Proto-Indo-European Urhimat a lot more directly alive, because they never stopped being the steppe nomad sort of raiders, which our own ancestors really were when you get right down to it. So they prioritized the wandering wind deific on horseback with a spear as being the sort of the chief of their particular end of things. And in fact, there's a great bit from Herodotus's Persian Wars. We're unlike the Zoroastrians, so this is double word score, you might sort of say. Darius has launched this invasion of Scythia for various sorts of reasons. It might be a mythic recurrence. We'll go into that a bit later. And he's trying to bring the Scythians to battle. And he's saying, "You cowards! You will not come out and fight. We can't find you anywhere." And the Scythian king sends back an emissary and says, "Look, we're not cowards. The reason why you can't find us to fight is because you're trying to look for these big-ass cities and fortifications. We don't live that way. But we're not cowards either. The only lords we acknowledge are Deus, my father, and Vesta, my mother." So in other words, they're claiming direct descent from the gods, another very Indo-European thing to do. "And if you should believe us to be cowards, then come seek out the barrows where our fathers are interned, and we shall be found for battle there, and you'll see exactly what our metal is, broadly speaking." Anyway, the point is, these guys carried out this incredible migratory and raiding culture all the way from northern Greece, where the Athenians actually sort of incorporated them in as a sort of police force. It's a weird sort of occasion. That's another thing the Europeans tend to do. We turn up as mercenaries and basically sort of wind up running the place by default, but I digress. They have a material culture featuring the common sort of motifs of the stag and other sorts of, well, often serpent taming, curiously enough, which is attestable via barrow finds in both the Pontic Steppe and, of course, the Tarim Basin, northern Afghanistan, and stuff like that. They turn up in Indian, Indian historical chronicles mentioned as the Saka. The idea is that the fundamental etymological root of this, which brings us on to the next thing we should probably address, is they're the guys who shoot things or spear things or skewer things. All of these have that SKW etymological root. Now, I've digressed wildly. The archaeological side of things, which shows, along with the archaeogenetic side of things, these migrations, is also incredibly strong in showing not only that X people started out here in the Urhimat and then diffused across the steppes in both directions, but also some core common features, especially going east through the Andronova and Santosha cultural horizons, as they're known, to wind up in India. So we can basically trace not only the genetics, but the hard material culture and the worship elements, which is particularly relevant for what we do, that tend to go alongside this and then turn up in the Vedas themselves. So prioritization of the horse, the chariot, horse burials, particular social stratification, which go alongside that, and later Nordic society, the same sort of stuff tends to turn up. Now, I've spent much too much time on this, so I'll get direct on linguistics. The other thing that's really quite important for what we do, even before we get on to mythology, is the linguistic side of stuff. And this is actually what unlocked all of this in the Well, actually, as far back as the 1600s, it was talked about in European academic circles. But what really came into its own was in the late 1700s, early 1800s, when European empires sort of started to expand into India and were conducting these comparative analyses on the wisdom, the ancient texts and languages they found there. They had academics going, hold the phone. This looks really close to Latin and Portuguese. Why does it look really close to Latin and Portuguese? Why is it that it doesn't just look close to it in terms of these being, you know, isolated coincidences, but actually the grammar has some common features? Maybe we can construct a model which shows how these languages relate to each other. Ah, we can. And we can build in all of these other languages, like the Persian side of things, the various other sort of European languages, not Finnish and stuff like that, that's a non-Indo-European language. Hold on a minute. Our model seems to be, quite strongly even predictive for these languages which occur in the Indosphere and in Europe. What should
right,
we
I
call
want to interject here a bit to make sure everyone realizes that sometimes we get the questions about linguistics that people seem to be under the impression that the entire field of linguistics is looking at words that look kind of similar and almost guessing that they must be related. But I want to be clear here that when we talk about the science of linguistics, there are specific rules that say, for instance, A turns into D here and D turns into T here. And they can be used to predict from one language to the other exactly how the language evolves. It's not just looking at words and thinking they look similar. It is, in fact, a very scientific, precise model.
Exactly.
Yeah, these days do all the computer modeling. And the curious thing about the computer modeling is it's been done by hand for a while. We now actually have diffusion models for how words, languages sort of transmit and spread via migratory pathways, which are also used to sort of support the Urhimat hypothesis, well, theory I've just previously advanced. But in terms of an example of some of these sound shift laws in practice, I've already mentioned one, which is quite, important. And that is the PF sound shift which goes on. Now, the classic example of this is father, or as we encounter in a lot of older and more sort of archaic Indo-European languages, Peter, Peter, those sorts of things. It means pretty much exactly the same thing. The P has turned into an F. We also mentioned that with Parvat in terms of mountain and Fial in terms of, raised areas of the mountain thing. In terms of
Even within Germanic sources, we see this with the letters D and T tend to be rather conflated, especially amongst West Germans, like English, for example, where you'll see such issues as Wotan turns into Woden, or Othin turns into Woden in English.
Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of one of my favorite examples of this, this also happens within the Indo-Iranian subfamily specifically. There's a noted rule of S-sounding consonants turning into H's when they migrate from the older, particularly from Sanskrit Indo-Aryan, Indo-Aryan is the pre-Sanskrit language, into the Iranian languages, older Western, old Persian, that sort of thing. S goes into H. So, for example, we have Thoma, which is likely to be psilocybin mushroom based. Funny enough, that's another common Indo-European feature. We're a very drug using people, but I digress. In terms of Thoma going into Haoma, is the the Zoroastrian and Persian cognate. But my favorite example of this is we have a phrase, Sena, which basically means army. They have a word Hena, which means invading army, enemy army, thing to run away from, basically. A similar example of which turns up in the shift from, I think it's Harja, Harja in Old Norse, into pretty much the same term in older Finnish language, whereby it goes from meaning in Old Norse, army, raiding, that kind of thing, into Finnish, where it means, predator, demon, malefic spirit, thing to run away from really fast. Now, in both cases, the Zoroastrian Persians and the Finnish, what's happening here is not just a calquing would be a technical term, not just a linguistic incorporation or a sound shift, but actually a preserved racial cultural memory of the time when the Indo-Europeans, or in the case of the Persians, the Indians, turning up meant run for the hills because these guys are going to kill you, which is once again a very common Indo-European thing to do to the neighboring people down the road, whether they're Indo-European or not. So in terms of the linguistics, what we have is a really good set of models and tools which are in fact predictive in their accuracy. Now, that might sound curious, but when it comes to some of the Anatolian languages, we're still actually digging up a lot of the scriptural inscriptions for Luwian, Lycian. Now, that's actually a bit of a tangent because Lycian in particular, the ethnonym there effectively means something along the lines of the wolves who are at your door, I think is the slightly figurative translation of it. You can see the Lycian, the wolf element to it. But the point is, we're still digging up their civilizations. And therefore, this is giving us this entire semi-new scriptural written corpus to play around with when it comes to our predictive models. And I say predictive models because it turns out the models are in fact predictive in their accuracy. So in terms of the veracity, the viability of using linguistic analysis to trace back not only the languages, but the concepts which sort of are contained within those languages, because really, when you think about it, how you view the world is expressed in, well, how you express yourself, the things you actually have words for. This is called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which basically relates to the idea that if you can't think of it, then you're not going to have a word for it, and vice versa. It doesn't quite work out quite like that in practice, but you see exactly what I sort of mean. So in terms of what me and Tristan do a lot of, which is, I suppose, the capstone on it, we're not linguists. We just happen to be rather surprisingly good at it in some particular fields. I'm a theologian. I'm not quite sure what he described himself as, but probably good looking. But in terms of what we do, we look at mythography and comparative religion, comparative Indo-European mytho-religion. The linguistics is very strongly useful for this because it preserves the concepts which are so integral to how people believed about things, the rituals and rites which they sort of practiced. Now, a grand example of this is, in fact, the striker slash thunderer deific archetype, which is one of the core Indo-European gods.
Now, Kerwin, before you get too far into that interjection here, I want to note that we are quickly running out of time. I do have some questions I wanted to ask you here. If we could go back to, you mentioned the Vedas earlier. Could you explain to some of our, because as you know, most of the people listening to this are going to be of the Germanic persuasion. Can you explain to them the differences between the historical Vedic religion and modern Hinduism? And also, can you explain which is more similar to the Germanic faith and how?
That is a trick question and a half. In fact, it's three trick questions. But anyway, Vedas, the etymological root for this, because I love etymology, as you know, is exactly the same as video. Video in Latin, I mean, not that kind of video, but well, the same thing. See, revealed. So the Vedas are revealed. Revealed is also etymologically related. I forget whether Eddas is also correlate, but it amuses the hell out of me quite frequently that you guys have Eddas, we have Vedas. Now, in terms of the Vedas themselves, these are the really ancient, in fact, they're pretty much the oldest intact texts we really have for pretty much anybody on the planet, because they're from about, depending upon the dating you want to use, 3,500 to 4,000 years ago would be the broad range of dating. Now, there's four layers of them. The Rig Veda is the oldest. I think the Atharva Veda might be the most recent. I forget. My brain's not quite sort of functioning properly. But there's various sort of layers of them which expand upon the previous concepts of the layer before them. Now, expand upon does not mean introduces a whole hell of a lot of stuff out of left outfield. It doesn't work like that. What it does mean is it gives more detail about what was previously a rather brief, you know, sort of almost mnemonic, you know, sort of this is how I remember and pass things, and sort of turns a one-sentence mention into a few paragraphs worth of explication, so to speak. A classic example of this, and this also does build on Tristan's question more directly, is the Day of Hakaran Kali, which, of course, is familiar to everybody, because everybody's in Indiana Jones' Temple of Doom, which is a really bad example of somebody misrepresenting Hinduism. In fact, it was banned in India because they thought it was a Muslim plot to sort of, you know, make Hinduism look bad. But I digress. Those Pakistanis, it gets blamed for everything. Anyway, the point is, people will say sometimes, and some of my recent work's been on this, oh, there's no Kali in the Vedas. This therefore means Kali must be a Dravidian incorporation because she's black. Kali literally means black, by the way, amongst other things, including death and time. Fascinating digression for another topic. The thing is, Kali derives from Kel, a Proto-Indo-European particle meaning to cover, in the manner of sort of a shroud or a veil, like night, which is, you can see where the blackness and the time element of it sort of come into it. It's also, funny enough, the etymological predicate for hell, so you can sort of see where the death side of it may come into it as well. The sense is going beyond the veil to the realm of the dead, but I digress. The point is, Ratri, which means night, once again, does have hymnals in the Rig Veda, or one hymnal in particular, but many other attestations, more hymnals in the Atharva Veda, and then as Kalratri, as Kali herself, has a much more expansive sort of role in later Hinduism. This does not mean that this particular goddess turned up as a, you know, a Dravidian incorporation or something. All it means is that the more common theonym turned, well, up in more common usage a bit later on, but the same goddess, same iconographic features, same associations had been present right the way through and was just now being talked about more in the texts which we have available to us. Now, this goes back to one of the deities I mentioned at the start of this particular podcast, Hanuman, Bajrang Bali. Now, Hanuman, like I said, people will say, oh, this deity, you know, must be a Puranic. The Puranas are sort of later on period of Hindu thought. Must be a later incorporation. Must be from the subcontinent. As we've explored, this is not, in fact, the case. I mean, yes, obviously from the subcontinent in the form of that particular monkey, leaving aside the correlates elsewhere. But there's actually a mention in the Rig Veda. I think it's him... 36 of the 10th mandala, which I know off the top of my head for various reasons we won't go into on air, there's a mention of Lord Indra. Indra, of course, being quite strongly correlate with, you know, sort of Thor and Zeus and so on and so forth. And we'll leave that aside for a moment. Basically saying, look, Vrishakapi, I'm mispronouncing that again, I'm sorry, the monkey sort of figure is also an acceptable facing of me to worship, which goes to the same place, i.e. me. Therefore, the monkey lord is, in fact, given a Rig Vedic precedence right there in the oldest layers of the text, thus clearly showing how this later deific, which is often picked up upon as being this strange incorporation, which is non-Indo-European, is, in fact, very Indo-European, even before we get to the very strong coterminities of role, function, portfolio, iconography, and other such elements. So in terms of what Tristan's getting towards here, the idea that some hard and fast distinction between Puranic era Hinduism and Vedic era Hinduism, I don't think it really works. Now, I will say at this particular point that certain beliefs and practices may have turned up later on as a result of development within the Hindu corpus. So the Vaishnava end of things, which goes, oh, hey, we're going to run basically, you know, sort of strict monotheism almost and be downright dickish some of the time. No offense to some good Vaishnavas out there. There are some good Vaishnavas out there, but you're probably acquainted with some of them. But some of the HKs in particular, the way they do things, that is not something which has a really good, authentic ancient Indo-European or Vedic sort of precedence. Yeah. That is the knowledge to turn up later on. But the core of the rituals which we use to this day in terms of our worship and temples and stuff like that, not only do they have ancient Vedic precedence, But as we've seen with the excellent work which the Norona Society is doing, which we do some consultative support for, they have strong correlates. They have stuff that you can see exactly how it is a local form of going both ways in Nordic religion as well, thus demonstrating the fact that there is contiguity both in terms of time and in terms of space between the Indo-European religions in ancient and modern form.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Mr. Kerwin, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dave. I was going to say, Kerwin, what you're saying really when you get right down to it is that the modern Hindu model isn't notably different from the Vedic model. I mean, some of the practices are a little bit different, but it's more like a continuation of the old Vedic practices.
What I would say, is it's a refinement in some areas, an expansion in other areas, and a de-emphasis of some other stuff. Now, when I say de-emphasis, it's a point of some controversy today for reasons, because everybody forgets their own history after a while, and that's part of the reason why you have a priestcast, to keep these sorts of things alive and in the mind of the people who sort of specialize in this sort of stuff. But ancient Vedic Hinduism was quite big on animal sacrifice. Like, it's still practiced in some parts of modern Hinduism today. I think it was last year or the year before, the really big, like, slaughter 10,000 oxen sort of stuff still going on in Nepal wound up being, but I think it got banned up there just last year. I'll have to check my facts on that. But the point is, in many parts of India, animal sacrifice is really quite taboo. There's been a cultural shift within Hinduism to basically sort of say, we are going to stop doing this because we have slightly different sort of valuations on on animal life and on the potential animal cruelty involved in carrying out these particular sorts of rites. It's still in there in the archaic layers of text. It's still in there in the modern layers of text. It's just that there are a particular set of substitution principles also in the Vedic layer of text, which we're looking into just recently as it happens, around using basically desserts and other things that are precious and valuable to you and which have a life force to them, instead of the actual life force of an animal and having it bleed out as part of your rite. So there have been stuff that has sort of fallen by the wayside in terms of a lot of the cultural practice. It's just that the stuff that goes around it, the particular mantras, the particular hymnals, are still used today, even though some of the actual manifestations of the practice have in fact been changed to more modern appropriate manners. And I stress that's not a universal thing as applies to animal sacrifice, because to this day, various parts of India still do carry out exactly those ancient rites as they've been going on continuously for 4,000 years, completely unmitigated.
Right, and I do believe that's an important thing to know, because people who are going from outside the circle here might not be aware that Hinduism isn't a giant a giant umbrella group where everyone believes exactly the same thing, and you really have to view it as composed of a bunch of microcosms of sometimes very rapidly different sects and cults and stuff, the worships of various different gods and deities and beliefs. Like you said, some parts of India do carry out mass animal sacrifice, whereas some parts are often rather vehement. I mean, we've had entire arguments with people who come up and they refuse to believe that the Vedas actually proclaim animal sacrifice.
Yeah, I mean, that's an issue whereby, like I said, people often want to forget particular aspects and elements of their past because they want to believe that whatever it is they've been doing is always the way it's sort of been done, and that the strange-looking white man might not have a particular point when it comes to schooling them on their own religious history. But that is another matter for another time.
Now, we are a little bit over time, but we're having such a great conversation here. I think we have time for one more topic, if you guys are cool with it.
I do have one more question, in fact, so it works out great.
Let's do it.
So, Kerwin, would you say that Hinduism can be used as a good religious model for the reconstruction of the Germanic faith? How much can we look into Hinduism and the Vedic works? And how much should we leave outside to use our own tradition? Is there a way to calc this together where they can both be correct?
Well, see, that's... literally all and everything right there, especially considering it's what we spend about 20 hours a day doing. Part of the reason why I'm so innovative at the moment. Now, in terms of your actual sort of question, the core element, as I've earlier stressed, around our comparative mythography is often that there is good reason to keep some stuff separate to respect the distinctiveness and the diversity of endogenous practices of particular people. There's also good reason in some cases to go, hold on a minute, we don't actually have the stuff endogenous to this particular people, therefore we're probably going to have to wind up patching in some DNA strands from elsewhere, which we know and can determine fit neatly into the spaces where we're missing stuff, and possibly not fudging, but weaving things together. I forget what the term is for it, but it's that Japanese art form where you smash up a bit of pottery and then you casually weld it back together with the gold in the seams to make a new fancy looking pot that's kind of got a gold marble effect going on.
But before you go on, you're not talking about syncretism, though.
No, thank you for bringing that up. Now, syncretism is basically, in our particular meaning of the term, putting together stuff that is unlike. So when the Macedonians, Greeks and Romans, or later on the Romans, got to Egypt and decided that as a tool of political control, they were going to casually smoosh up various Greek deities with deities of the Egyptians to sort of make it a bit easier for them to accept their new Indo-European, they already had Indo-European overlords, another topic another time. That is syncretism. That's putting together stuff that is not alike and, saying, oh, hey, well, yeah, like this is totally the same thing, guys. Yeah, definitely. This is not what we do. What we do is we illuminate the already the same thing, which has just been obscurated, the degree of codominity, the degree of sameness, the degree of identicality, identity being quite core to that, in the elements in question. So you can see already how that's quite different. So, in terms of when I talk about Shiva, Odin, Rudra.
Yeah. If you don't mind, I'd like to interject and add something about the syncretism argument, because we do witness a lot of syncretism. What syncretism is what, as Kerwin described, is kind of mix matching and putting things together. And now, while like this entire stream is talking about how we have a similar root in the Indo-European tradition, or trying to find the root of the Indo-European tradition, or even just using that as like a beacon so we can quantify and further analyze and do the study of what the things, the cognates and everything that has commonality in existing traditions, so that we may not only just reconstruct the missing pieces of our faith, but also to just learn more about ourselves and, break the mold of what is established history in academia. Because as we all know, a lot of that crap is wrong. But with syncretism and a school of thought that is really, really guilty of this, and some people in the chat are going to get triggered, but I want you guys to hear me out, is perennialism. Perennialism is notorious for breeding syncretists. They think that they could just take, just because, oh, well, we're all Indo-European, I could take bits and pieces from here and there and here and there, and they end up with this Frankenstein. The reason that syncretism is so bad is because each individual tradition operates in harmony with itself. It's like its own ecosystem, or it's like a car. I think I said this to Tristan, or maybe it was Kerwin pretty recently, about the car metaphor. When you have a car, you say you want to build a Chevy or whatever. You say you want to build a Chevy, you want to build a Camaro. You got the 350 small block, you got a specific drivetrain, you need all the specific pieces to make it into a Camaro, right, for it to run right. Well, with syncretism, you're not getting all the right pieces. And in fact, what you're going to end up doing is you're going to start putting in pieces that do the same thing. Like, how the heck are you going to have a Camaro that has three mismatched wheels, two transmissions, and no engine? Like, it's not going to make any sense. And that's exactly what you're doing with syncretism, is you're building this hideous, profane, Frankenstein monster, instead of trying to do what we're doing, which is take an existing tradition that has some pieces missing, do the proper research and use scientific methods to find the correct pieces that still exist elsewhere and put them in and make it whole again. What do you think about my analogy there, Mr. Kerwin?
That is excellent. What I would note with some amusement is that the person you in fact told the car metaphor to previously was both of us. we do have a slight, to explain for viewers what's going on there, me and Tristan appear to share a lot of headspace quite frequently, to the point that we have not only a telepathy thing going on, but the way I'd actually phrase it is Mitra Varuna. Insofar as he's Mitra, I'm Varuna, but I digress. In terms of your analysis, yeah, you're pretty much on the money. The reason why syncretism and perennialism especially is dangerous is because it erases the actual substance and useful distinction of various things in favor of a false. It's easier if we just consider everything to be one. Now, this gets into a whole series of further shows we could do around particular conceptions of both the Indo-Europeans as a people, or peoples, I should say, mankind, by the way. I do this every now and then, but Trudeau, when he came into that controversy last year, because he was saying, you know, like man or mankind or whatever, as opposed to person kind or whatever,
yeah, people
because
kind,
it was discriminatory,
yeah.
He was, in fact, accidentally correct, which is a lot of the time the best kind of correct to be. Because, you see, what mankind means, it's not a gender thing. Well, it kind of is. It means the relatives, the kinspeople of Manus, or Manu, as we know him in the Hindu tradition. Manus, of course, being the Germanic progenitor, Manu being the Hindu progenitor, and Romulus, once again, linguistically sort of related, is, funny enough, the Latin reflex of the same figure. So in other words, saying mankind is a discriminatory term. It is. It just means the Indo-Europeans, and if you're not Indo-European, then I'm sorry, but that's, you're going to have to fight. You're a human. That's a different thing. But anyway, I digress.
To compound on that, actually, people always ask me, and I actually got asked this today as well, if you consider all of the Indo-Europeans to be one people, where does it end? Like, does it go into rampant universalism? And I always tell people that you can look at the situation and ask, well, are these people sons of Manu, or sons of Manus, as it is in the Germanic tradition? And if the answer is no, then these are not our people. It's very cut and dry.
This may get rather amusing as applies some particular features of Zoroastrian cosmogony, but again, another show for another time. What I would append to that is there are some special cases out there. Now, as applies the whole Aryan Dravidian internet backdraft flame war, you basically sort of say, I take a bit of a different view to a lot of people, insofar as if you look at the strong resonances of Tamil culture, religion, and contribution, especially to the Shaivite sort of corpus especially, I don't think in that particular special case it is as easy as saying these guys are or were sort of foreign, have nothing to do with us, so on and so forth. Because, however it happened, they wound up strongly bound to especially the Shaivite end of things and making a useful, you could almost say divinely inspired, in fact, you could say that, contribution back to the Indo-European sphere in that particular regard. That is a minor tangent, but I do feel it necessary to acknowledge, especially because we've seen this with sort of first-hand eyes, but I digress. What I was actually sort of wanting to pick up on, though, is in addition to trying to reconstruct the Nordic mytho-religious complex, a large part of what we do, as applies to the Nazi end of things, Nordic Aryan Sangha, is it's given us the tool to also consider some of these peoples within a broader Indo-European context, as in all the Indo-Europeans. Now, this gets on to that discussion around the Nordic and Vedic caste systems, which I sort of briefly alluded to towards the start of the show. Now, the Nordic caste system effectively is three and a half clades, you might sort of say. The bottom are the thralls, they're not people, allegedly. I can't say that on air, but I digress. The next one up, of course, being the Karls, which, of course, is men, of course, therefore Charlemagne, great man. One above that being the Jarls, how you want to pronounce the J in that particular thing. And above that, from the Jarls, first amongst equals, you might sort of say, is the Khan, the king, so on and so forth. Now,
and then you also have the Bondiman, right? Bondimen, whatever.
Right. The Bondi are not actually part of the traditional caste system, but they do exist within Nordic society. It's really, they kind of fit between thralls and proper Karls. It's, It is actually a rather interesting position, because I like to say that they're almost like the fourth cast that never was.
Yeah.
That'd be sounding a bit like your shooters. But in terms of...
with the cast system, though, because I think a lot of people are going to be kind of a little bit lost on this. Just like a quick little definition for each cast. Thrall, as Kerwin said, were essentially not quite slaves, but they were part of a cast that belonged to the landowner. And then you had the Carls, who were they were the I guess you could say they were the wealthy landowners, or the lords, or something of that nature.
Right. I would say the Carls are anything from, I mean, strictly speaking, it's just a free man. But realistically speaking, we're talking about anyone who is part of a household who can support themselves.
Yeah. And then you have the Jarls, who are the priests and the kings and stuff like that. And then you had your overarching kind of king class.
Well, I wouldn't call it king class, but I take your point, yeah. And in the rig still, the king is a particular individual with a particular level of genetic heredity from a particular deity, but that's a solid issue. In terms of where I'm going with
Divine
this...
Divine king, which is also Indo-European.
Very strongly so.
But in terms of where I'm going with this, this is another point which I explore in Ghost Division, amongst many other of my writings. You look at what this setup is basically there to promote, and then you follow in the eschatological analysis, because Mark's apparently now in my head as well. Great guy, Mark Booyah. You look at the ideal destination for somebody who's lived the best kind of Nordic life. Tends to be somebody going to a warrior heaven, because, they've done glorious deeds. Appropriately enough, it doesn't seem to matter whether you're Christian or if you're, sticking to your ancestral religion, as one particular Nordic king found out much to his amazement. If Odin wants you, that's where you go. Anyway, the point is, the sociological setup of the Nordic caste system and the mytho-religious complex which is associated with it is to produce these great warriors, these great explorers, these great assemblers of kitset furniture, that kind of stuff. Now, that is very useful for not only where the Nordic people were in their particular sort of end of things, but also when we then look over at the Vedic caste model as a comparative, the four castes which we have there going up in sort of order, Shudras are basically peasants. Now, it's necessary for me to point out that Shudras are not thralls. Shudras have souls, but that's a minor sort of point to that indirect. The next one up, which is the Dvija Varna, which, Dvija 2, Duo, that kind of thing. I'm pronouncing that egregiously badly, I'm sorry. Vaishyas. Vaishyas are merchants. Next one above that, Kshatriyas, sort of knights, warriors, lords, also the kings. And the one above, sort of adjacent to that, but in an upwards manner, are the Brahmins, or of course the priests, also the academics, and things of that particular nature. Now, the model for this is known as the Purusha model of society, for the Katharvana model. This has the Shudras as being the thighs, I think some models might have the feet of society. They sort of support everything because we're all sort of standing on them legs. It's still part of the body. The Vaishyas, now merchants come in for a lot of stick for various reasons, especially when they wind up running things as opposed to serving others, but I digress. The Vaishyas are the digestive tract. That is to say, they're the thing that consumes, but also then sends the stuff that is being digested around the rest of the body and nourishes the rest of society via the material distribution that keeps everything sort of ticking over and running. Can't have a society that functions without being able to eat. An army marches on its stomach, as Napoleon once said. Above that, you have the Kshatriyas. Now, the Kshatriyas are the arms of society. They are the rulers. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean ruler in terms of a king, although also that, but kind of like policeman. The long arm of the law would be the appropriate modern English idiom for the concept that's being expressed there. Now, above that, in this sort of Purusha sort of model, your Brahmins are your head, because that contains two things. Your brain, which has your memory in it as well, very important thing, but also quite importantly, the mouth, the vocal cords. The Hotter directly sort of refers to that, funny enough, but it's not a topic for another time. So what you have is a corporatist, not in terms of corporations, but corporeal body, model of society, which all of the bits and pieces interlock and work together, but which also, as a feature somewhat distinct from the Nordic sort of caste model, and this is where I'm going with all of this, really does quite heavily prize and support that Brahmin caste to actually keep alive in really good work and order all of these 4,000-year-old mytho-religious traditions, scriptural materials, and devotional practices, which are continuous operation for 4 millennia and counting, keep all of those alive right down to us here in the present day. So in terms of looking at the broad Indo-European sphere and saying, okay, so we got this Nordic society over here and this Vedic society over here, and looking at what each particular society is set up to generate, and in terms of the sociological complex side of thing, this is another thing we explore in Ghost Division, is the way in which priests, Brahmins, etc., Brahma Rakshasas, funny enough, are also in the Ainhoria equivalent of Odin in the Vedic corpus, the Bhutagana, amongst others. What you have is a situation where when we're doing this Nordic reconstructive work now, it's very handy, very handy, in fact, that's a Sanskrit pun, that we have this still living tradition kept alive by this priest caste over here in India to draw upon for the Nordic people who've managed to sort of fight and conquer for their independence over here in the West and bring the two things together. It's almost like it was designed that way. And that's where we actually come to in terms of Tristan's sort of core question. Because one of the guiding rubrics to a lot of what we do is the strength of canonicity of the materials which we're working with. Exegesis would be the technical term for this sort of analysis. Now, Word of God, Word of Gods, is a rather strong level of canonicity. Gods do occasionally not tell the whole truth, we might sort of say, especially if they're gods well-renowned for acting and occasionally sort of playing interesting practical jokes, we might potentially sort of phrase it as. But it's very difficult to dispute Word of God as a strongly canonical source of material to draw from when we're actually sort of working with these sorts of texts. We then add to these ancient texts, the more ancient often the better, or at least the tradition in question which is being preserved, which is more ancient being the better, some level of inference and occasional direct personal revelation, although that must be very, very carefully regarded because a lot of people have a lot of very strange things which they ascribe to personal revelation, which is probably smoking a bit much weed or something like that, which can be a useful tool, but I digress. But in terms of the overarching purpose, because I'm rapidly into a tangent here, you can see how all these things start to interlock and actually form a useful, viable chariot to take your car metaphor and turn it into a very ancient thing, which is a useful war machine for the step of the modern age, which is the war against McWorld in the world.
Excellent, excellent. So, Mr. Tristan, is there anything? Because I think we're almost a half hour over. We should probably shut it down. Is there anything else you'd like to conclude with?
No, I think I actually got to all of my questions. In fact, Kerwin answered half of them without even me being able to pose it. As he said, that telepathic link we have going here.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Anyway, I would like to thank Kerwin, my erstwhile associate, for coming on and being interviewed by us here.
I'd like to thank you guys for having me on once again, and I'd like to point out that I did not, in fact, manage to suffer an inconvenient death in the course of proceedings, even though it was half an hour of time.
Yeah.
Very glad. Very glad.
Excellent. Excellent stuff. Yeah. So thanks again, Mr. Kerwin, for coming on. It's always, always excellent having you on, man. What a really brilliant and fascinating guy Mr. Kerwin is. And I implore everybody to go check out Kerwin's work. You can find him over on Facebook. And as Mr. Tristan said, him and Kerwin are two parts of the founding members of Ari Akasha Institute, which is a really mind-blowing, just really mind-blowing project that they have going on. They dig deep into things that really blow apart what you watch on the History Channel. It's really incredible work what they're doing. And a lot of it, as Mr. Kerwin mentioned earlier, helps out with us in the Neurona Society as well, which me and Mr. Tristan are both a part of. And it's really just, I can't even tell you guys how fascinating and interesting and wonderful. My experiences with working with these guys and working with Neurona Society and all these really brilliant, big-minded people. It's just, it's absolutely tremendous. And I was just telling Mr. Tristan earlier, with our work and our research and our the stuff that we're coming out with and our content being on an upward trajectory, us as people are really on an upward trajectory. One of my kinsmen, a guy that's really close to me, got reunited with one of his children. A friend of mine, his health is improving every single day. He sends me updates all the time. He was in a really bad physical spot, and now he's like really moving up in the world. It just seems like as this research keeps going and growing, and as we develop spiritually and as we develop better ways to spend our devotion, our lives are improving. We just have momentum, and I have such a wonderful feeling about everything that's going on. I've been saying for many years that we are approaching a golden age within the Kali Yuga, or within the wolf age, as we say over here in the Germanic end. I'm sure Kerwin has some theological discrepancies with my description of the Kali Yuga. However, just the overarching idea of this being kind of like the age of confusion, the age of darkness, and so many of us experience this, man. I have so many young guys that I'm buddies with. I kind of do like a big brother thing, and when somebody reaches out and they say, man, I tell them all the time, man, things are getting better. Things are really getting better all around us. Everything is confusing and dark, but if we spend our devotion to the gods and to the ancestral tradition, the real authentic tradition of our ancestors, and we spend our time with love and happiness and virtue and giving good and spreading gift for a gift and living in frith with our brothers and sisters and our kin and our community and stuff, man, everything is just, I can't even begin to tell you guys how good I feel about our future coming up. I just did a post on Facebook talking about Lord of the Rings and how much I love the character Sam and stuff like that. Towards the end of the little post I did, I said, if we invoke the archetype of Sam as an archetype of virtue and truth and honesty and loyalty and humility and all of these things, we might not be able to save the world. However, we might be able to build a world for our true friends and our loved ones that looks a little bit more like the Shire and a little bit less like Mordor. And I think that's where we're going with this kind of work. So, we are doing a lot of academic stuff, and we do dig into all this stuff, but this stuff does have practical use. And looking at the people that surround us and how their lives are improving, and how I believe that the gods are really, really starting to wake up and come back to life, and as our society gets its virility and its fertility back and gets its energy back and all this stuff, it's just, it's so important with us in our journey to spiritual healing and individual and also cultural healing as well. Man, we're all healing together, and I attribute a lot of it to this groundbreaking work that all of us are doing in Arya Akasha, Neurona Society, all the wonderful other organizations and awesome researchers and teachers that are out there. Man, we're waking up, man. We're coming home. And it's so important to me, and I just think it's such a wonderful, beautiful thing. And thank you guys for all of the wonderful work that you guys do with Arya Akasha. It means so much to me and to so many other people. And man, thank you again, Mr. Kerwin, for coming on the bog, man. The bog, not the bog. So we didn't bog Mr. Kerwin tonight. In fact, we all raised ourselves up to a position of nobility. But anyway, we're going to shut it down for this evening. I'd like to thank my co-host, Mr. Tristan, for doing such a wonderful, excellent job with this interview. And he's a natural. This is like his first time co-hosting on a podcast. He's like a freaking natural. Very proud of you, Mr. Tristan. But we are going to close it out for this evening. But like always, I want to give a shout out to my homegirl, Miss Hannah, at Traditional Apothecary, traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Let me tell you guys something. That stuff that you buy, the shampoo, the soap, the body wash, all that stuff that you guys buy off the shelf at the supermarket, is filled with poison. It's filled with poison. Synthetics, plastics, all kinds of weird chemicals that trash your hair, trash your body, trash your skin, dry out. Dude, let me tell you, dude, we have some of the most beautiful features in the world. Our ancestors gifted us with such beautiful features. We should let it shine and be proud of it. We're talking about the Indo-Europeans. Man, the Indo-Europeans rode chariots all over the world, conquering and fighting and burning so they could give us these wonderful, beautiful features that we have. So let's take care of them and let them shine and use real organic stuff that's grown from the earth in our homelands of America and Europe and New Zealand, like Mr. Kerwin's from. And, get some of this stuff, man. I'm telling you guys, you're going to absolutely love it. I use it. My wife uses it. My mom uses it. Dr. G uses it. My boy Dr. G, he's a real doctor. His wife uses it. I have friends that, man, I get messages all the time, people that use it, and they say they love it. So it's absolutely great. Keep your white bright, keep your beard robust, and keep your mane flowing just like Big Dave. Go to traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Use promo code Dave to get 10% off. Thank you so much all the time. To all you guys, man, I love you guys, man. Many blessings. Hail to you guys. Hail the folk. Hail my mods in the chat. And I see Miss Folkfire in there. That's my homegirl. She runs Hroffen Folk still over there. So make sure you guys stay over there. They got so much great stuff coming. That's my homegirl there. Much love to you, Miss Michelle. I love you. But I'll see you guys next time, next Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern, here on the Bog. Me and Tristan are coming back. I don't know what we're going to do yet, but it's going to be great. So I'll see you guys then. Hail.